look at this to find out what other kinds of additions we might want to include under that toll-free number.
If you had a safety net, you know, a house, and a, like they have the women's crisis home, if they had a safety net for these children to go to and say, well, I'm going through this abuse, there is a probation going on. These are the things I'm saying, where they don't have to feel totally in jeopardized by CSD because they feel threatened. They are taught to be threatened of CSD. If they could feel as if they could go to this place and say, well, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I like, I do not like, that is a neutral territory, I think that the courts could get a lot further with the kids. They would understand better.
Okay. Are there any questions, comments? Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it. Now, I recognize your name that you were signed up the other day on another bill, and I apologize for not for realizing it was the wrong one. Thank you. Okay. Let's here, there's no one else who's been signed up on House Bill 2407. Let's move on down the list to 2413. Mary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm the chair of the Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children. Just as a way of introduction, this is an outgrowth of really a lot of struggle by the committee itself. We looked at the fact that juvenile records cannot be expunged for sex offenses. And when we were out having public hearings, we heard from some young people that were very concerned about having a lifetime stigma and having this on their record, especially if they had made major strides and really had done well in treatment. We debated that back and forth, and we still felt, as a task force, not to ask for any changes in the law. And this represents House Bill 2413, I think, a way to maybe accommodate some of these young people that have really done well in treatment.
Senator Cohen, members of the committee, I'm Don Welch, director of the Clackamas County Juvenile Department. Once again, in this context, however, I'm speaking to you as a member of the Governor's Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children. 2413, in the abstract, has nothing to do with sex offenses. And indeed, what it does is modify a piece of legislation, or a piece of statute that's been with us for since 1979. And what it has done is to, in effect, to have codified in 1979 the practice of the juvenile court in a substantial number of its cases. That is, dealing with matters without a formal adjudication, treating people on probation. And for the first time, what it did was establish standards in terms of the rights of the individual to have the agreement in writing and the right to counsel. And among other ingredients of that understanding that became the informal probation agreement section, was its duration of only 6 months. What we, in the intervening 12 years, what we've discovered in many kinds of cases is that 6 months is a rather short time to deal with a probation relationship. And that came home particularly during the testimony we heard relative to sex offenses against children by children. And I say children because it's increasingly the case, as you heard from Representative Courtney, that those who are charged with sex offenses are reaching down below the teenage years, even in some cases to single-digit ages. But more to the point, perhaps, is the proposition that as young people learn about their sexuality, there's a broad spectrum of behavior in which they engage, which runs the gamut from the sort of exploration that most people probably would consider not unhealthy to serious aggressive conduct, which has grossly deleterious effects on both the victim and the perpetrator. As we heard from people who were involved in the treatment business, we began to see a split. And most people were substantially dubious about the potential for treatment of adult offenders. There seemed a near unanimity of thought, however, that juvenile offenders were susceptible to treatment. And as the treatment people with their various philosophies spoke to us, one of the ingredients they always seemed to emphasize was the need to have a case formally adjudicated in the juvenile court. That interested me, and I asked in each instance the basis for that posture. And what it came down to was really two things. One was that if you didn't have sufficient time to treat an individual, you were frustrating the undertaking. And the conventional wisdom, as we heard in the committee, was that you're talking about a two-year spectrum of time as the logical treatment time for juvenile sex offenders. The other and more subtle issue was what I come down to and use the word clout to describe, and that is it is vital to the treatment process based on the opinions of every treatment person I heard, that the perpetrator acknowledged the behavior. And there was a substantial misunderstanding, because indeed it was a misunderstanding, that a person who was on informal probation did not have to account for their behavior in treatment. In reality, an individual who is placed on informal probation can be held to terms and conditions of probation as can an adult. And among those can be successful participation in a counseling program. The rub has always been for the sex offender that 6 months was simply too short a time. Now, the formal court process is often useful, and sometimes it's vital to processing the kind of cases we're talking about. And I might even expand beyond offenses against children and sex offenses, although that certainly is our focus. But there are a substantial number of cases in which the individual is willing to acknowledge the behavior and get on with the treatment. Or, as we suggested earlier, there's an increasing number of cases in which the person who's charged is very young. And when we were talking about this in the House Judiciary Committee, I remember Representative Bauman thinking about a case she'd handled in Multnomah County where the chilling effect of having to walk into the courtroom in terms of a person's willingness to acknowledge their behavior and proceed with treatment, I think was a telling example for her of why it would be important for the potential for informal probation to be there if the person is otherwise willing to deal with their treatment needs. Now, we need to understand about what we're discussing several things. One is that the procedural rights of the individual are recognized and honored. The right to counsel, the child does not technically stand up in a courtroom and confess to a crime. But the state also has its rights protected because a person who participates in an informal probation contract unsuccessfully, that is, they don't live up to the standards of the written contract, and it's all in writing, can be brought back to court on the original charge without a speedy trial argument. And therefore, in the cases for which informal probation is appropriate, everybody is protected. And the state can always bring it back if it needs to. The child is always able to say, no, wait a minute, I want to go into a court of law and have a judge determine whether or not this occurred. So that's always available. When we appeared before the House Judiciary Committee, we had with us an individual who initially was opposed to the idea, but when we talked about it being a process which would be available for 2 or more years, then Richard King, who's the director of the Clackamas Adolescent Intervention Services, which is a sexual treatment program, one of at least 3 I can think of in our county, came forward and testified in support of this particular measure because we're dealing with a population which, frankly, we don't understand well. And we are learning, and as Representative Courtney told you, over the last decade we've been learning a great deal. But it's clear to the treatment individuals, it's clear to us, and it was clear to the committee, and apparently to the House, that this is an important, worthwhile, additional treatment potential as we try to approach this very frustrating dilemma of how to deal with this behavior by teenagers and younger individuals. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mark McDonald and Robert Coons. Appreciate people being willing to come up, a couple people at a time, because it does save time in getting through things.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark McDonald, appearing on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association and the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm the senior deputy at the Multnomah County Juvenile Unit of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office.
My name is Robert Coons. I'm here representing Crime Victims United.
Yeah, let's go ahead and hear from Mark first.
Okay. Go ahead. We are opposed to House Bill 2413 for several reasons. First, informal dispositions, ORS 419-630, was originally enacted to deal with relatively minor offenses in an expeditious manner, such things as shoplifting and vandalism. And I think that is reflected in the fact that the period of duration is only 6 months in length. They wanted to be able to, kids who are doing relatively minor things, to come in and have it handled informally and get it off the record without having to go through the court process. An informal disposition is a contractual agreement between the juvenile department and juveniles whereby the juvenile department agrees not to file a petition, which is a complaint in a criminal case, if the child does certain things. Maybe community service, maybe go to a drug information program. It can be essentially anything that the juvenile department requires. The purpose of House Bill 2413 is to encourage the use of informal dispositions in more serious cases. And I would point out that under the current state of the law, informal dispositions can be used for any law violation, whether it be murder, aggravated murder, rape, sodomy, arson, strong-arm robbery. Any of those offenses can be handled by way of an informal disposition. One of the obvious impediments to that is the fact that the period of duration of the agreement is only 6 months in length. Obviously, if that period were extended to 5 years, there would be a greater encouragement to use these informal dispositions for any type of offense. Now, Mr. Welch indicates that the purpose of 2413 is to circumvent the non-expungement provisions of the juvenile code, which indicates that sex offenses committed against children cannot be expunged. However, informal dispositions are inappropriate in sex offenses for several reasons. First and foremost is that the statute, ORS 419.640 sub 6, prohibits requiring the child to make an admission as a condition to participate in a informal disposition agreement. The reason that that is a problem and makes informal dispositions inappropriate is that all treatment providers agree that the fundamental first step towards successful treatment of a sex offender is admission of responsibility, that the person did something wrong. And because the informal dispositions prohibit an admission, what it, in actuality it happens is it tends to enable juveniles and their families to continue in their denial that anything inappropriate happened. I deal in my job with a lot of treatment providers who work with sex offenders, and they indicate all to me, including Mr. King from the CASE program, that they have a much higher success rate in treating sex offenders of those who have successfully, who have been adjudicated, as opposed to those who are participating in an informal disposition. Mr. King has indicated during testimony in hearings in which I've been a party that his success rate in treating sex offenders from Multnomah County, where an admission is required, is much higher than that of Clackamas County, which handles most of their cases by way of informal disposition, and the admission of guilt or responsibility is not included. He has indicated to me privately that his success rate with dealing with sex offenders from Clackamas County is only 1 in 4. Another problem of informal dispositions is that it has no sanction.
What would you suggest we do with this bill? I mean, I guess,
well,
what do you want?
I would ask the committee of one or two things, either to defeat the bill, not pass it out of committee, or limit it to non-person felony offenses as defined by the sentencing guidelines.
We don't have sentencing guidelines in juvenile court.
No, but as by defined.
Well, we're not going
to. That would be things other than homicides, arson, sex offenses, robbery.
What's your suggestion on how to deal with these kids? What do you want? How do you want to deal with them? We had a bill in this committee sort of waiting, pending the arrival of these bills. We have a Senate bill which we didn't hear, which required adjudication and then allowed for expungement. Based on the earlier interim testimony we'd had from people saying that if you know that was was mandatory adjudication for the reasons you talk about, but then expungement on the other side, assume at some point that they finish their treatment appropriately. So I guess that we're waiting to see and what's here in front of us today, but your testimony doesn't help me very much in terms of what your suggestions are with respect to how to deal with these youngsters.
I guess what I would say, unless there's evidence that shows that sex offenders can be successfully treated or cured, and the treatment...
You're talking about 8, 9, 10-year-olds.
Well, there's going to be a question of whether or not the state has a case that it can prove, and one of the elements of any criminal case is the ability to show that there's a mens rea, that the person...
Okay, we're talking about juveniles now.
I understand.
We're talking primarily a lot of, as I see it, a lot of 10, 12, 13-year-olds as well.
Well, I would submit that children 10, 12, and 13, if the facts are sufficient, the state can prove the elements, they should be adjudicated. I guess what I'm saying is that unless there's evidence to the contrary that sex offenders can be cured, and all the treatment providers that I have talked to, and I've talked to a lot of them, indicated that there is no evidence that they can be cured. They hope that they can be cured, but there is no evidence definitely that they can be. They can be treated like an alcoholic can be treated to avoid certain circumstances which put them at risk to reoffend. But until there's evidence that they can be cured, if the state has a case which it can prove, and one of those elements is the mens rea element, and age and sophistication is obviously going to be an important factor in determining whether or not the state can prove the mens rea.
What do you do with them if you know it's happened?
And
you still have a 9-year-old.
Well, there's always the potentiality to handle as a dependency matter.
What do you do with them?
Well,
you adjudicate them as a dependency matter and you don't follow them at all? You leave them?
No, they are made wards of the court, and they can remain wards of the court until age 21.
That doesn't help treating them.
Well, the condition...
Give them a hammer to treat them.
The condition of wardship can be that they complete a treatment program. What I'm saying is if the state can prove its case, I would submit that it's better to handle by way of adjudication. Because the success rate in treatment for those juveniles, sex offenders who have been adjudicated, or at least where there has been admission, such as required in Multnomah County, is much higher than that in which they are handled by way of an informal disposition. Now, in regards to this, I would like to address just one other thing that Mitchell Wells said, that all parties are not hurt by this. I submit that there are no sanctions to informal dispositions because the only sanction is to return the matter to court. Now, if we extend informal dispositions to 5 years and that, we say, 18 months, 2-3 years down the road, the child has not successfully completed his treatment program, that he is blowing it off, the only sanction is to return it to trial, and then the state would have to go back and try to find its witnesses. Obviously, memories are going to be impaired. There is going to be some witnesses unavailable. But most importantly, victims of these cases are going to tell the state to get lost. They have finally been able to start to put their lives back together. It has been my experience that when these matters have been handled informally, is that the victims of these offenses feel like they've been betrayed by the justice system, and that 2-3 years down the road, when they start to put their lives back together, they're not going to want to cooperate. And I submit to the committee that this is a major loophole in handling these matters and making sex offenders responsible for the acts they commit. It's inconsistent with the other legislation that this committee is considering here today.
Senator Hill.
Yes, thank you. Mark, did you, was there on the task force, was there someone from the prosecution?
Mr. Collins from Yamhill County, and I've had conversations with him, and he indicated to me privately that he had concerns about this and didn't really...
Why do we have all these private concerns? Why don't we just kind of have public concerns here?
Well,
Mark, it's okay.
This is what he indicated to me.
Thank you.
He indicated to the, it was Mr. Welch's who pushed this through the task force, and that it was his idea. And Mr. Welch indicated that he handled, as he testified in the House Judiciary Committee, that they handled approximately 80% of all delinquency matters by means of informal disposition in Clackamas County.
So Mr. Collins did not give your kind of testimony to the task force?
No, he did not. And
we're
going to
hear from John later on.
Okay.
We can ask him.
I just want to ask, did you present this information to the House committee?
I was not aware of a hearing. Unfortunately, it was early in the session. It was a bill that got through without our organization being aware of it.
Just wanted to know. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Coons.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, once again, my name is Bob Coons. I here representing Crime Victims United. We, too, did not know the nature of this bill until it already passed the House. And the way we found out about it is we were discussing an expungement legislation that you folks have considered. And through that discussion, we became aware of the true purpose of this bill, because the bill itself, as was pointed out by Mr. Welch and others, is a rather innocuous-looking piece of legislation. The purpose of the bill, though, is not innocuous from our point of view. And I think that as a representative of victims, and there are a number of our members who have been victimized by juveniles. And at this point, I'd like to say to you that when you become a victim of a crime, whether it is done by a 12-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid, or whether it's done by somebody that's 86, the effect is exactly the same. It has absolutely just as devastating an impact upon your life. It can be just as destructive whether it is 8 or 80. And so we want to start from that standpoint. From a public safety standpoint, then, we urge you that if we're going to err, if we don't know, if we can't come up here and make some reasonable guarantees about the success of our ability to treat for this, we certainly say let's err from a public safety standpoint. At least let us know. At least let us have the opportunity to know what this child might have been guilty of. I certainly would agree, and please don't misunderstand our position on this. From our point of view, we would say that that treatment ought to be focused at the juvenile level, that we think that we're much more apt to get more bang for our buck if we treat at the juvenile level than if we wait and treat at the adult level. We have no quarrel with that. We have no quarrel with extending these things. What we have the quarrel with is the type of crimes that this is going to be applied to, according to Mr. Welch's a testimony. And finally, then, the other issue that I'd like to speak to you about is that we find it quite distressing in the victims' movement when we hear the juvenile authorities talk about accountability, that one of the major reasons for the system that we presently have is to make people accountable for their crimes. And I would suggest to you that this particular piece of legislation does exactly the opposite. We neither require them for an admission to the crime, nor does the state assign the guilt of the crime if they're handled through an informal matter. And we just simply, philosophically, that is not the thing to do. If we believe in accountability, then let's make people accountable. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you. Ross Shepherd. That's why we have a two-body system, folks.
I'd like to hear a response from the advocates of this.
Okay.
Ross Shepherd, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Informal disposition is a valuable and appropriate alternative in the juvenile court setting, and you certainly should not consider taking away this option at any point. But I guess the distinction I'd ask you to make is following up on the task force's recommendation between sex crimes and non-sex crimes, and we should have a five-year period for the informal disposition on sexual offenses, but I would suggest you either leave the rest of the offenses that can be treated this way either at 6 months or perhaps extended to a year. Thank you.
So your testimony would indicate you don't want just plain blanket 5 years.
No, I think that if we had a runaway juvenile department and we had a shoplifter that all of a sudden ended up on 5 year informal disposition, that would not be right.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Yes,
Senator Hill.
Why the distinction for sex offenses?
Well, I think treatment just is acknowledged to take longer for sex offenses if it is to be successful, and I think that there are some sex offenders that can be successfully treated. But if we have a child who's shoplifting or even doing an unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, that person on a informal disposition is without an attorney and is asked and is forced to do all those things that a child that has been adjudicated is asked to do.
Madam Chair. Ross, what about the testimony of Mr. McDonald about those who are formally charged tend to have more successful treatment?
I don't know if that's true or not. I think it would be my experience in the non-sexual offenses that it doesn't make any difference.
But, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm not sure that Ross is all that expert in sex offenses. That's what everybody's saying. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker.
I would like to hear from the proponents of the measure who first testified to us to respond to the testimony against the measure, particularly the problem of informal disposition not involving an admission of wrongdoing, and how yet you yourselves say that that's very important to successful treatment, yet you can't get that if you go the wrongful disposition route. And I'd like a response to that, but and then in more generally also just to respond to that testimony.
Fine. Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, it is entirely accurate to say that the limitations of the agreement are such that a child does not have to acknowledge their guilt.
It's not, but I understood him to say not permitted to acknowledge.
Well, all right. It shall be completed. It shall be voluntary. It shall be revocable. It shall not require an admission of guilt to be used as evidence of guilt. All right. So it shall not, it cannot require that the child plead guilty. However, it also cannot be used in evidence against a child in an adjudicatory hearing. And the point that I was making and continue to make is that there is an adjudicative admission. There's a judicial statement, and that's one thing which is excluded. That's quite another phenomenon than going into a treatment environment and acknowledging your behavior. And one would, if you are in a treatment environment and are with the treatment person and make a statement. My rusty knowledge of rules of evidence said that that's a privileged communication. That saying that it does not, cannot be required that the child make an admission in court has nothing to do with what happens in that treatment environment. And it is the treatment environment that we hear the person who acknowledges their behavior and then deals with it being equally susceptible to that as an informal or a formal, except for the six-month limitation. And the catch-22 of the presentation relative to the success rate, which is inconsistent, I must say, with the testimony on the House side, because what we heard from Mr. King at that point was essentially a, I think it was 100% success rate, but I don't want to get into that. That was the testimony, and I can't differentiate what was heard outside of that room. But the catch-22 of that is that, by definition, at this juncture, a child who goes into an informal probation relationship and then into treatment can only be held there for 6 months. And so the, what we're trying to establish here is give us long enough in that environment for the treatment to take hold, and the conventional wisdom is 2 years. Now, the look on your face, Senator, suggests to me that there's already said.
What do you do with a kid who cannot be asked if he committed the wrong during the juvenile proceeding? Madam Chair, I have a question of Ross. It says, as they would revise it, a complaint of sexual misconduct made by the witness. Is there any limitation on that? I mean, does that necessarily mean the victim?
That's the difficulty.
And I didn't hear you say that, I guess.
That is the difficulty, and that could be any witness, I
That's
suspect.
That's what I would think.
And if an individual's charged with rape, say, or sexual misconduct, and there are other witnesses that have made statements to somebody else, this section could be read to cover them, too.
Is there any reason why it shouldn't just say the victim or the complaining?
Then it would take it out of the sphere of the civil litigation, which is what the proponents do not want to have happen.
Why would it?
There's also the dilemma that a victim could be a victim of any other crime alleged against the person who was there, either as a
well, a complaint of sexual misconduct made by the victim of the alleged sexual misconduct. I mean,
the dilemma is that this is always traditionally applied to the misconduct at issue in the proceeding. In other words, if we charge rape, it can be the complaint of that rape. If it's expanded to the civil arena, if it's a tort action based on a rape, then this complaint should only be for that rape, not for other rapes on other victims. Changing the word witness to victim doesn't seem to resolve that, because you're going to be a victim whether you were of rape one or rape three. So their concern is that it not go to other crimes or other misconduct than that at issue in the proceeding, and that's what we...
Then we have two concerns. One, that it not go to crimes other than those at issue, and that it not be extended to witnesses other than the victim.
Well, it's a hearsay exception, so it does go to witnesses other than the victim. This entitles people who heard the victim complain to come in and say, she came to me and said that she had been raped.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's hear from Mark Blackman, who I think you can ask any questions to as well.
Good afternoon.
And after that, Paul Drews and Beverly Wright. So let's, Mark, for the record.
I'm Mark Blackman from Portland, appearing on behalf of the ACLU to oppose 2395. I actually came prepared to some extent to address the proposed amendments in Section 18, but before I do that, I would like to address the language that now appears as Section 1 and suggest that if it is read to add something to the Act that isn't already covered by Section 4, which relate to statements made for diagnosis or treatment, then I think it's a potentially very dangerous addition to the law, especially since it doesn't describe at all who the statement maker is, or whether what the diagnosis is. It basically creates a category of admissible statements that could be by anyone that resulted in a finding of no abuse or no misconduct. I think the strictures that apply to the subsection 4 kinds of statements are more than adequate to cover what we should be concerned about, and I think one either should add nothing, in which case it's not necessary, or it adds something that we don't and can't anticipate, in which case I think it's a bad idea. With respect to subsection 18, as a matter of, I guess, policy, I would say that any additional restrictions on what I guess we call meeting witnesses face-to-face is, I think, to be avoided, and that includes expanding it into types of proceedings that are not currently covered, and also to the types of circumstances where meeting witnesses face-to-face is avoided. And I say that for a couple of reasons. I know Ms. Swenson asked if the Oregon constitutional provision regarding meeting witnesses face-to-face has a different implication than the so-called confrontation clause of the federal constitution. I would say quickly that some years ago I wrote a little article about this and made a presentation in a OSB ACLU-sponsored program on what Article 1, Section 11 means, and I think I checked with Stevie Remington just now, and she thinks one copy of that book may still be extant, and we will try and get it to you. I think it does describe the differences. Historically, Oregon has, the Oregon Supreme Court did, in about 40 years ago, interpret the meeting witnesses face-to-face language to mean something more than just mere confrontation. I can't remember the name of the case, but we can get that for you. I think the real concern here is whether or not we are dealing with a process that can assure reliability of the facts by the time all is said and done. And I think two things I'd like you to keep in mind when you consider this. The first is that if you expand this into the area of civil litigation, that would include such proceedings as domestic relations proceedings. And I think it is undisputed that there is an increasing amount of allegation of sexual abuse that arises in that context, where there is a custody dispute and parent A is involved in an allegation that parent B has been abusing the child. The Bureau of Police Standards and Training has recently issued materials for people working with child abuse or in the child abuse field, training materials for interview and investigation. And I believe you will find that the BPSD has, in its materials, reported that 70% of the allegations of abuse that arise in the domestic relations context turn out to be unfounded. I do a lot of work representing school teachers and people who provide care for children, daycare center type situations. And the BPSD materials indicate that well over 50% of the allegations that arise in that context are, in fact, unfounded. What this proposal would do would be to limit the face-to-face meeting between the alleged accused and the alleged victim. And I know that the purpose of that is to try and protect the child from the kinds of pressures that we envision as being involved there. But what I think we have to remember is that children are not immune from pressures even outside of the courtroom, and indeed are more often subject to pressures and the kinds of pressures that are extremely difficult to protect the child from outside the courtroom. And it's not from the alleged abuser that those pressures are coming. A child in the custody of one parent is, by definition, more subject to the direction and guidance of that parent. A child who is in the custody of CSD is similarly involved in a constant, ongoing dynamic between the child and those people in the legal in whose legal custody the child is, which can have either a subtle or sometimes not so subtle effect on the way the child interacts. And it's only when you get into the situation where the child is has an opportunity free of those pressures that you sometimes get to the truth. And I don't mean to tell you war stories here, but I think that any lawyer who practices in this field with any regularity at all will tell you that children, certainly well under the age of 13, can be extremely relieved to be in the situation where the judge is protecting that kid from everybody, from parent A as well as parent B, and who can, under those circumstances, simply explain what did or didn't happen and who did or didn't urge the child to say or repeat or otherwise certain information. Now, what I you know, we're always fighting the last war, but one of my partners is in a trial right now. It arose out of a child custody battle. The child was at a hearing today, and after the child testified, was observed to leave the courtroom to be reunited with the non-accused parent and one of the non-accused parent's parents. And because the non-accused parent was in the courtroom while the child testified, the grandmother asked, well, how did it go? And the non-accused parent reported to the grandmother that the child did it just perfect. And then the grandmother asked the child where she wanted to go for lunch, because she had earned the choice of where to go for lunch. Now, those are things from which the child cannot be protected, but which do impinge on the reliability of the evidence that the trier of fact is hearing. And I think we need to protect that process. And the only way it happens is if people can see what's happening and you have some balance of advantage in the process. So I guess the summary is that we would urge that you not expand the exception that is currently in the law, and that you recognize, for example, at line 36 of page 3, where it talks about a hearing in the presence of the attorney and a parent when that parent is not the alleged perpetrator, that really what you're doing there is writing into the law something that may be very contrary to the child's best interest. The thing that is in the child's best interest in all of these proceedings is that they be able to tell the truth without fear of consequence from any source, not just from the supposed reaction of the alleged perpetrator. There are also some technical things I didn't quite understand. For example, at the bottom of page 4 and the top of page 5, it talks about, the very end of page 4, it says, only the judge, the attorneys for the parties, etc., shall be present. And then the next sentence says, the judge and the alleged perpetrator shall be allowed to communicate with the persons in the room where the child is testifying. So I don't quite understand if the judge is in two places or is only permitted to communicate by electronic devices. It's very confusing to me. But I think you will find that in order to retain reliability, you need to, no one objects to creating circumstances that will engender a sense of well-being and safety in the child when he or she is testifying. You know, I'm a great proponent of taking all of these cases, regardless of whether they're criminal, civil, juvenile, and taking them out of a courtroom altogether. I tried a case in a municipal court recently. I was representing a teacher. We tried it in the Oregon City commissioner's room, which is just like your, you know, just a, not a very attractive room, but it's just a room with card tables and people just sitting around. And it was a perfect setting for this kind of a examination, because people just don't feel like some people are up here and some people down there. Kids can relate to it. And if you want to make something, some changes in the law that will assure that we get to the bottom of things and have kids able to testify freely and truthfully, I think we ought to say that, have a rule that says these cases will be tried in courtrooms, they'll be tried in living rooms. I think you'd find that you get a lot more accomplished that way.
Thank you. Other questions? Thanks very much. Paul Drews, and we'll hear from Beverly Wright.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Drews. I'm the Acting Assistant Administrator for Child Protective Services of the Children's Services Division. And I've provided you with some written testimony. I would like to make just a few comments, primarily on the testimony that's gone before. Mr. Gardner very ably, I believe, answered the question of why expand the hearsay exception into both juvenile and civil matters. And I guess the one point I would like to add to what he said is that a large percentage of the sexual abuse cases against children that we become involved in that do not lead to criminal prosecution. Less than 10% have a criminal case that is also going on. Most of the procedures that are happening in court are happening in juvenile court, which is why I believe it's very important to pass this bill. Second point that I would like to speak to, previous witness from the ACLU made a couple of comments that I would like to comment on. At one point, he said that it's undisputed that there is a rise in the allegations in domestic relations cases. I would dispute that. Our statistics do not show that, and the national studies that I've seen do not show that, that there is not a rise. Those kinds of allegations do occur in domestic relations cases, but I know of no study that shows that they are on the rise. Second statement that he made was that there are a large percentage of unfounded determinations in child sex abuse cases. I would like to point out that if I understand the meaning of that term, it's very important to remember that unfounded doesn't mean the child lied. Unfounded, as we use it, means that we are unable to prove that abuse occurred. And it is true that a fairly substantial portion of the cases that we become involved in doing assessments and investigations do end up unfounded. But that's different than saying that the child lied or the child was forced to lie. And I just want the committee to understand that.
I'm not sure that's what he said, either, or remand.
By the use of that term.
Right. Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. Beverly.
Yes, Beverly Wright. I'm really against this law because you're getting into real touchy territory. You have to specify exactly who's going to do the work with the child to get the testimony. I feel it's very therapeutic for the child. I was personally offended that they did not even come to me or consider me a witness in my own trial. It is very therapeutic for the child to come up and say, hey, this happened, this is what I felt, this is what I saw, this is what happened to me, and have the judge say, we acknowledge this. If they have to do it outside of a courtroom, the person who needs to be with that child is someone who cannot possibly benefit by the conviction or non-conviction of the perpetrator. And I find that there really isn't anyone who can do that. You could go to a teacher, but that teacher can be chased down. My father personally chased down three acquaintances, friends of mine, and grabbed each of them by the throat and threw them to a wall and threatened their lives for having any involvement with me, which could prove his guilt instead of innocence. If you do this hearsay and the perpetrator knows who is working with the child to help coax honesty from them where they feel safe, you're not only in jeopardizing the child, but you are in jeopardizing the person who does it. It has to be someone that he does not know who they are, where they live, and they'll be in need of a restraining order because the mentality of these people is quite brutal. And they are a real threat to whoever helps a victim get through the testimony. But I believe they need to testify and come forth. If that means they need to take the perpetrator out into another room and let him hear over there and let the young lady or young boy in the courtroom next to the judge, feeling he's being or she is being heard, and they know a courtroom, they know it's a place of authority, they will feel protected. If you remove the perpetrator instead of the child, I think it'd be a little more effective. They would feel secure and heard. Otherwise, like the living room setup, they may just feel it's just another counseling session. They may not take in that they're actually being heard about what happened. And it's just a real dangerous situation when you get into hearsay, because on the other hand, I know personally a man who would not admit to a crime of incest, which he did not commit, which was brought forth by his wife against his stepdaughter, and there was no proof that he had done it, and only proof that he had not done it, that he could not have been there to have done the crime. But she wanted to get a divorce and to make sure that he had no custody over those children. And what better way than having him sent to jail for incest? He would not admit to a crime that he did not commit. He had people who were afraid to come forward with evidence that he could not have done such a crime because he was not in the area at the time that it was alleged. And yet he went to jail because he would not admit to it. Whereas someone who does admit to it is given probation and set out again to do it all over again. Now, this man spent 6 years in prison because he was innocent and was unwilling to admit to something he did not do. And it all began because she wanted custody of those children. So this hearsay, she got up there and got that daughter to say what she wanted said, got custody of her children, got him in jail, and there is no way he can get near his child either. So it can be really threatening, and unless you have real absolute who's going to be there and how it's going to be held, it's not going to work.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes. Yes. You mentioned, of course, not having the perpetrator there. What about your other parent?
Well, the mothers, in many cases, my mother to this day is still with my father and supporting him, has been for 10 years. Now, the parents, when it's a joint marriage, mom knows. She knows. There's no way that they cannot know. They can swear that they don't. They can cry and carry on, but they know. My mother talked me out of saying different, like, such as in a course. I admitted to that first four front with the CSD worker. My mother took me aside and said, oh no, this couldn't have possibly have happened. He only did this, not that. And told me what I was to say, when I was to say it. And then the courts went ahead and plea bargained him down and dropped off my sister. They never contacted my two other sisters or my two brothers or my half-sister or the neighborhood kids. Right now in Silverton, where the area that we live, there is a barrage of young women of my age, a little older, who have it out to see this man stoned to death because he is in the vicinity. And my mother is right there to this moment protecting him, saying he is healed, saying he is better, coaxing me to turn my daughters over for a visit. It's not a chance. You know, there are several things about mom which is not in sync. She is enabling him to continue the abuse. She is covering for him. My mother would work night shifts so he would have his availability towards her own children. And yet to this day, and says, no, I had no idea of knowing. But that's impossible. And mother will lie for him, protect him, go to work for him, clean up after his mess, shut up the children, do everything she can. You put mom in the courtroom and with one look can shut a child down. The child won't talk because mom's right there. The mother, you know, my belief is when you bring these children up and you know mom had a hand in it because she was unwilling to protect her child, which is normal and natural, mom should be an accessory to the crime because she has done everything in her power to enable and continue his abuse. She is unwilling to protect or even try to be there for that child or children. And she helps him continue his illness because it feeds her own illness. If he gets well, he won't need her anymore. And since there's no real hope of him getting well, it just keeps cycling over and over again.
So that should be someone new.
Yeah, you should just, mom should have nothing to do with it. Girlfriend should have nothing to do with it. Those people who could benefit by him going to jail, if they can benefit by getting full custody of the kids, the house, the car, the boat, they have no business testifying. If you're talking about a physician who is a confidant of the child, who is separate, that person is not going to benefit or lose. He has no manipulating reasons. He has no feeding of his own sick whatevers. So you would be in a better place to have someone who is completely neutral, have mom out of the courtroom, take the perpetrator and stick him in a jail cell, and let the child speak before a few people, attorneys, a jury, let them speak to where they know they're okay. They know that this is a court of law. It's not the courtroom that frightens a child. I was angry. I was standing in the hall when they did my father's trials. They would not let me in. And I'm what it's all about. You know, that hurts them. They're pushed to the side. So if you let the child in the courtroom, let him talk to the judge, let him feel like he's being vindicated, it will work. But you have to keep the perpetrator out of the room. You know, he can listen on the other screen.
Madam Chair, how old were you?
I was 16 when I turned him in, and the abuse was proven from infancy.
Okay, thank you. I want to get that.
Thank you. Okay, let's take 2415 and then 2412. 2415, we just have Chris Gardner here. Great. Chris, on 2415, please.
Uh, 2415 was recommended, and it's not the most wholesome topic to talk about. It's actually probably a little embarrassing, but basically what we had in Oregon was a sort of a bifurcated sex offense scheme. If you were to place, if a perpetrator were to put, this is kind of embarrassing, but
We've all been through it. Some of us were here when we passed the original sexual penetration bill on the
bottom line is this, is that a perpetrator who puts his penis, his tongue, or a Coke bottle in the vagina of a victim is subject to categories of crime that range from A felonies to C felonies. But if you were to put your finger, your fist, your elbow, your toe, your nose, your ear, and in the House committee it was suggested we limit that to parts of the hand, and I said, well, that's a good expansion, but given the nature of this area, I know the next case I get is going to be somebody using their ear or something odd. This is just an odd area. You fall into a different category of crime, so the most serious conviction you could get for placing your whole hand in a young child's vagina would be a C felony. So what we intended to do was to make penetration really the cutoff between those two levels of crimes. And then fondling or sexual contact other than penetration would be dealt with as a sex abuse category of offenses.
Yes, any questions?
Mr. Chair, perhaps I could ask a question. As written, Chris, basically, though, since it includes any body part other than the penis, it would include the tongue or mouth, right?
Right.
So it would overlap with sodomy.
Actually, what I would suggest is that you would put any penetration not subject to the rape or sodomy statutes to have that track to make sure we're not creating an overlapping offense.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Yes, we'll now move to our public hearings on, is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2415? Then we'll move to our public hearing on House Bill 2412,
Paul Drews.
I do too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
And members of the committee, once again, I'm Paul Drews, Acting Assistant Administrator for Child Protective Services. I've given you some written testimony. I'm here to support this bill. And just want to reinforce the notion that the governor's task force found, and that is that often children who are victims of sex crimes, particularly very young children, are victimized a second time by the anxiety and the fear that they feel at facing the court process and the length of time that it takes for that process to be resolved. So basically what this bill does is ask the courts to expedite any trial in which the child is going to be a witness. I would also say that you're going to hear testimony shortly from the Attorney General's office asking that you consider amending the bill and adding termination of parental rights proceedings. And I just want to state for the record that the Children's Services Division would support such an amendment.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much, Paul. Yes, yes. Mary Horton, Chris Gardner, again, please. Sorry, I should have called you first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Hoyt, again, Task Force Chair. The bill is really very straightforward. I think during all the testimony we heard going around the state was the pain and almost the re-victimization of many of these children who have to wait a year and a half to conclude the proceedings. And we felt if there was any way to expedite that, that would help the child to move on to the healing process. So it's a pretty straightforward bill.
Thank you.
First of all, I'm Chris Gardner from the Oregon District Attorney's Association and from Deschutes County District Attorney's Office. Let me just practically tell you how this works. We have five trials set on any given day. You have a 12-year-old victim. You subpoena them 2 months before the trial. Their trial date is going to be May the 20th. Let's make it May the 21st. On the afternoon of the 20th, the judge sits down, looks at his docket, and he goes, let's see, the oldest case settled, this case.